another theological seminary. He also did grad work in economics at the University of Virginia. He holds honorary Doctor of Law degrees from Stanford University and Southwestern Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. He is currently chairman of People for the American Way, a senior associate of the Kennery Foundation, and chairman of his international committee. Dr. Norman Geisler is an author, lecturer, and professor. He has taught philosophy, ethics, and related subjects for over 25 years. Dr. Geisler received his BA and MA degrees from Wheaton College and a PhD in philosophy from Loyola University. In addition, he has done graduate work at Wayne State University and Northwestern University. He has appeared on numerous radio and television programs, engaged in dozens of debates on social issues like the one today, and is a frequent lecturer on university campuses. The speaker today, as I said, will be speaking on the topic religion and state, wall of separation, four bridge of cooperation. They will be giving introductory speeches, a rebuttal, and a summation. And after the summation, we'll have time for questions from the audience. This is very important during today's debate that we have I use the phrase, decorum. Time should be strictly followed, and individuals should listen intently, and hopefully there won't be any disturbance. So now I'd like to begin today's debate by inviting Dr. Geisler to speak on the topic, religion and state, wall of separation, a bridge of cooperation.
Thank you. Since this is the 200th anniversary of our Constitution, it behooves us to take a closer look at exactly what it says. The First Amendment reads in part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It is noteworthy that the word separation does not occur in this amendment, to say nothing of any mythical wall of separation between religion and government. The first word is Congress, that is, the federal government, and this federal government is forbidden to engage in the establishment of religion. The words are clear and unequivocal. While encouraging the free exercise of religion in general, they forbid the United States government from establishing any religion in particular. In short, the First Amendment encourages freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. That the framers of the Constitution did not believe that the prohibition against establishing religion was applicable to the state governments is demonstrated by the fact that 5 of the 13 states that ratified this amendment had their own state churches. As a matter of fact, state religions continued to as late as 1833 and were disestablished by their own free will. Rather than separation of religion and government, the First Amendment encourages cooperation between them. Indeed, it forbids the government from interfering with the free exercise of religion. What this cooperation meant to the Founding Fathers is evident both from their words and their actions. The father of the Constitution, James Madison, revealed his understanding of the First Amendment by these words that he proposed for it. The civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established. From this it is clear that Madison's interest was in allowing full religious freedom to all citizens of every state, while forbidding the federal government from establishing one national religion for all the states. Likewise, Virginia's ratifying convention stated that no particular religious sect or society ought to be favored or established by law in preference to others. Maryland's convention demanded that there be no national religion established by law. These quotations leave no doubt that the state had a national religion in mind when they ratified the constitutional words forbidding Congress, that is the federal government, from establishment of religion. Jefferson was not present at the Constitutional Convention. Nevertheless, later as president, he affirmed the same meaning of the First Amendment, saying, "Certainly no power to prescribe any religious exercise or to assume authority in religious discipline has been delegated to the general government. It must then rest with the state, as far as it can be, in any human authority." At no time while serving as President of the United States did Washington, Adams, Jefferson, or Madison deviate from this understanding of the meaning of the First Amendment. Not only do the words of the framers demonstrate that they never envisioned a wall of separation between the government and religion, but their actions are equally clear. Between 1789 and 1814, there are no less than 7 presidential proclamations for national observance of Thanksgiving religious holiday. The uncompromising religious language of these proclamations demonstrate that rather than a wall of separation between religion and government, there was a bridge of cooperation. For while favoring no religion in particular, the federal government was here encouraging religion in general. At the request of the 60th House of Congress, President George Washington's first proclamation reads as follows. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor, now therefore I do recommend the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. The wording of this proclamation leaves no doubt that both Congress and the President were encouraging the whole nation to engage in a fervent religious practice. President James Madison proclaimed three successive Thanksgiving holy days between 1812 and 1814, declaring, quote, "Whereas the Congress of the United States, by a joint resolution of the two houses, have signified a request that a day may be recommended to observe by the people of the United States with religious solemnity as a day of public humiliation and prayer. I do therefore recommend this third Thursday be set apart for the devout purpose of rendering the sovereign of the universe and the benefactor of mankind the public homage due to his holy attributes," end quote. In addition to these presidential proclamations encouraging religion, the U.S. Congress on four occasions gave land and money to support religious activity. These land grant trusts read as follows, quote, "For the Society of the United Brethren for the Proclamation of the Gospel among the Heathen," end quote. Two of these were signed by President John Adams, and two were signed by President Thomas Jefferson. In supporting these government subsidies of non-discriminatory religious activity, Jefferson clearly saw no wall of separation, but rather a bridge of cooperation whereby the government and the church worked together for a common goal of civilizing the Indians. Indeed, in 1803, Jefferson signed a treaty with the Kaskaskian Indians which declared, quote, "Whereas the greater part of the said tribe have been baptized and received into the Catholic Church, the United States will give annually for 7 years $100 toward the support of a priest of that religion who will engage to perform for said tribe the duties of his office," end quote. Jefferson did not view this federal subsidy of a Catholic missionary as a violation of a wall of separation, but rather as a bridge of cooperation whereby the state could use religious means to attain its secular ends. Even when this practice ceased in 1896, it was not because the court declared it unconstitutional, but simply because the Congress found it to be no longer necessary. The same spirit of cooperation between government and religion is manifest in the wording of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which declared, quote, "Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of learning shall forever be encouraged." As late as 1952, Justice William O. Douglas confessed that we are a religious people and our institutions presuppose a religious being. Indeed, the court in ruling against polygamy in the Reynolds case, 1892, went so far as to characterize Americans in general as, quote, "a Christian people," end quote. One thing is certain, the government has encouraged religion from the very beginning. In an hour of crisis at the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin reminded his compatriots, "Our prayers were heard, and they were graciously answered. Do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance?" From that moment to this, Congress has invoked God's blessing on their daily sessions. They've also appointed government-paid chaplains for the military. They've given tax exemptions to religious groups. They have promoted "In God We Trust" as our national motto, "One Nation Under God" in our national pledge, and authorized a national anthem whose fourth stanza encourages us to praise God. The Supreme Court has approved the recitation of the Declaration of Independence that refers to nature's God, the Creator, divine providence, God-given unalienable rights, and the supreme judge of the world. In short, neither the Constitution, its framers, the early president, or acts of Congress support any mythical wall of separation between God and government, religion and politics. Rather, they evidence a constant and fruitful 200 years of traffic on the two-way bridge of cooperation between religion and government. Let us, then, continue to encourage this constitutional freedom of religion. Let us inscribe on our hearts the words of Jefferson that are engraved in granite in his memorial in Washington, D.C. God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation remain secure when we have removed the conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Thank you.
I now want to call upon Dr. Buchanan for an introductory speech.
Thank you very much, Moderator Graham. First, I appreciate your introduction. It's a lot nicer than one I received recently. The person got up and said, "Now we'll hear the dope from Washington." And you were kind enough not to mention the reason I'm a former member of Congress is because in our own Republican primary in the Birmingham area and my Democratic district, 6th District of Alabama, in September of 1980, my majority beat my brains out in Christian love. Which caused Mount Holly leader Bob Michael of the United States House of Representatives to introduce me even more irreverently recently. He said John Buchanan left Congress the same way he entered it. He was fired with enthusiasm. I have looked forward to being with you at AAUS. I've known from Scott Gibbons and Jay Plum and Patty Sullivan and others about you, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. The title that you have chosen reflects the difficulty of this subject. Church and state, a wall of separation or a bridge of cooperation. Nobody likes to erect walls. Everyone loves to build bridges. And hence the natural sentiment, wall of separation or bridge of cooperation, would surely be bridge of cooperation. But I am here to reflect to you the words of Thomas Jefferson, when he commended that act of a whole American people, as he called it, in erecting what he called a wall of separation between church and state in the passage and in the adoption of the First Amendment. It was once my privilege to attend Mr. Jefferson's university, and I am well aware that this man, who has been a president, asked that three things be inscribed on his tombstone. First, that he was founder of the University of Virginia. Second, that he was author of the Declaration of Independence. And third, that he was author of the Statute on Religious Liberty of the Virginia State Constitution. Those of us who went to UVA feel Mr. Jefferson chose well. He had a motto for our university. For here we are not afraid to follow the truth wherever it may lead us, nor to tolerate any error, so long as reason is left to combat. I would commend that motto to every university, to every legislative body, and to every citizen of our country. And in that spirit, I would like to say further that he chose well in choosing his authorship of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that governments are instituted among men to protect and secure these rights. On this concept was built our free society. But as a few years ago in 1976, we celebrated the bicentennial of that declaration, American Revolution. I think we need to understand that we had that great national celebration that was most appropriate. We need to understand that it is the bicentennial we now approach, the bicentennial of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It is the thing we should celebrate most of all, because what was really accomplished in the American Revolution was the great political achievement of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the values and principles embodied in that basic foundation upon which our free society was built. And surely if there is a cornerstone of the Bill of Rights, it is the First Amendment, with its guarantee, among other things, for religious liberty. Now, when Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison cooperated to get the Virginia Statute passed 200 years ago this year, they were indeed seeking to erect a wall of separation between church and state in the colony of Virginia. And it was this that became the basis for the First Amendment. And then state by state, the other states, one by one, adopted similar provisions for their state constitution. Why? Because they were against religion? Certainly not. This controversy is not between those who are religious and those who are not. Not between those who believe and don't believe. We are, as Dr. Geiger has said, a religious people. We were at the outset of our national life a religious people. But through generation after generation, Western civilization had witnessed crusades and inquisitions, the burning of heretics, the drowning of witches, religious wars of Christian against Jew and Protestant against Catholic and Protestant against Protestant. We have witnessed the sad scene of established churches in nations like England and the nations of Europe persecuting dissenting groups. Indeed, it was this situation that caused many of our Pilgrim Fathers to come to these shores, seeking a place they could live and work and worship in freedom. But do you know what they did when they arrived here? They began to establish state churches in the American colonies. And in Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson's colony of Virginia, Baptist ministers like them were beaten, imprisoned, and run out of town, while their Anglican counterparts were paid from the state treasury with tax funds. And in other colonies, it was Quakers or Catholics, so that Roger Williams founded a colony as a refuge for those who were victims of this persecution and as a place of religious liberty. And ironically, it was people like the Baptists in Virginia and the Deists in Virginia, I guess you'd call them secular humanists now, who worked to put through the statute of religious liberty in that state. And the whole idea was to provide for separation of church and state for the sake of religious liberty. We are a religious people, but we are a pluralistic people. It was even so at the beginning of our society. There were Anglicans and Baptists and Catholics and Quakers and Unitarians and Presbyterians and Jews and countless others. It is even more so today. The most recent Gallup poll show us to be a people, 90% of whom say they pray, 96% of whom say they believe in God, about 67% of whom say they go to church or synagogue with some degree of regularity. And yet we are even more pluralistic than we were in our beginning. We are Christians and Jews and Muslims and Buddhists and many other faiths. Our country is not only a melting pot, it is a rich mosaic of the world's peoples and cultures and faiths. And we, people from the American way, believe in that diversity, and in that pluralism there is strength, not weakness for our society. But in such a society that is, yes, religious, but also pluralistic, to protect the individual rights of American citizens, to show proper respect for the differing beliefs we hold, there must be this protection provided in the First Amendment, providing a wall of separation and guaranteeing that no sect at the national or the state level or any level stands in control of government. We are now on the eve of the celebration of the Bicentennial. And I would say to you, right at its heart lies the First Amendment. The fact of persecution, the fact of pluralism, the fact further that our founding fathers believed that the separation of church and state was best for religion itself, were among the reasons that this wall was erected. Roger Williams in the mid-1600s said, "The civil sword may make a nation of hypocrites and anti-Christians, but not one true Christian." I think modern experience demonstrates that. In Denmark, 93% of the people are Lutheran. There's 1 hour religious instruction in the schools every day for the first 10 years of the life of school, and only about 55% of the people say they believe in God. In Denmark, where there is required religious instruction that is similar in that Lutheran country, the statistics of those who attend church and who appear believers are even more dramatic in a country that's more than 80% dominantly Lutheran. In England, there are compulsory religious exercises in the schools of that Anglican country, and yet the average church attendance is about 4% of the population of Great Britain. Contrast that with the way religion has flourished in our atmosphere of liberty, and I think you may agree with Roger Williams that religion itself prospers within the atmosphere where the arm of government is not used to enforce its beliefs or its precepts, and where a free church and a free state operate in separation and with a wall between the two.
Now I'll call upon Dr. Geisler for a rebuttal.
Phrase wall of separation comes from Jefferson's Danbury Baptist letter, but there's several reasons that this metaphor is not definitive for interpreting the First Amendment. First of all, Jefferson played no part in formulating the First Amendment. He was not even at the Constitutional Convention. He was ambassador in France. Not being one of the framers, Jefferson should not be used as an authority in determining its meaning. Secondly, even if Jefferson's understanding is used, there is no real evidence that his view on the First Amendment was different from those who framed it. He too saw it as opposing a national religion, but not against state-established religion. In 1908, Jefferson declared in unequivocal language that, quote, "the power to prescribe any religious exercise does not reside in the federal government," he concludes, "it must then reside with the state." End quote. Third, a close look at the Danbury Baptist letter reveals that the wall of separation Jefferson spoke of was not between an individual state and its church, but between the federal government and the state with their religion. For he speaks clearly of the act of the whole American people through their legislature, that is, the federal government. He calls it the supreme will of the nation. Thus, removing any doubt, he is speaking of the federal, not the state government. Fourth, suppose that Jefferson's statement about a wall of separation is wrenched out of its historic context and placed in a post-1947 setting where the court ruled in Everson that neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. Even then, it is obvious that Jefferson's wall was neither absolute nor impregnable, as some have later claimed. This is evident for several reasons. First, as President of the United States, Jefferson signed a treaty with the Kaskaskian Indians authorizing government money to a Catholic priest to perform for said tribe the duties of his office. Second, Jefferson advocated cooperation between the state-established University of Virginia and religion, even recommending a Department of Divinity for the state-sponsored university. Third, Jefferson even put forth university laws against profane swearing. Fourth, Jefferson declared that university students should be expected to attend religious services. In brief, even if Jefferson believed some sort of wall of separation existed, it was only a barrier against governmental prescription of religion, but obviously not against governmental cooperation with religion. So even if there is a wall between church and state, there were many openings in the wall through which they could cooperate. In point of fact, the Supreme Court has in recent times recognized that the wall metaphor has serious limitations. In 1952 Zorach decision, the court admitted that the First Amendment does not say that in every and all respects there shall be a separation of church and state. Otherwise, the state and religion would be aliens to each other, hostile, suspicious, and even unfriendly. In the 1971 Lemon case, the Supreme Court acknowledged that the court's decision do not call for total separation of church and state. Hence, its requirements, far from being a wall, is a blurred, indistinct, and variable barrier. The same year, the court declared in Gillette that the metaphor of a wall or impassable barrier between church and state, taken too literally, may mislead constitutional analysis. For as Justice Reed wisely noted in 1948 McCollum case, a rule of law should not be drawn from a figure of speech. Especially as the So, we may add, when the figure of speech is not in the Constitution, is taken too literally, is used out of context, and was originated by someone who was not even a framer of the constitutional point in question. In point of fact, the so-called wall turns out to be only an indistinct barrier with many gates by which government and religion engage in friendly, non-hostile, and court-approved activities. In short, it is not really a wall of separation at all, but rather a bridge of cooperation between religion and government. A bridge, of course, does imply that there are two distinct spheres, but they are not separated by any secular Berlin Wall. Rather, they are united by a constitutional Golden Gate Bridge. The framers of the First Amendment would be truly surprised to return on the 200th anniversary of their Constitution and discover that in its name the courts have forbidden prayer, Bible reading, and the Ten Commandments, or the teaching of creation in the public schools. What a shock it would be to Washington, who prayed in Valley Forge, to discover that children no longer pray in Valley Forge schools. How incredulous Jefferson would be, whose abridged Bible of the life and morals of Jesus was promulgated by the 57th Congress in 1904, were he to return and find that his Bible was forbidden for classes to read in public schools. Indeed, were Washington, Adams, and Madison to return on this bicentennial anniversary of their Constitution and discover that secularists were using it to build a wall of separation between God and government, they would be scandalized. And what if these founding fathers were to discover that parents' tax money was used to support public schools that taught their children humanistic ideas and values contrary to their own? Well, believing that this is tyranny, they would undoubtedly start a second American Revolution.
And now I would call upon Dr. Buchanan for rebuttal.
If one reads the correspondence of Mr. Madison and Mr. Jefferson at the time they were working on the Virginia statute upon which the First Amendment was based, one comes quickly to the conclusion that that statute, which was even stronger than the First Amendment, was indeed intended by them to erect the wall of separation we've been talking about. And I think our founding fathers would come back to our country today and find that if people said that 90% of them prayed and 96% believed in God and 67% went to church and synagogue regularly, and they looked at all the wonderful diversity and pluralism and how we are living as one people within that framework of diversity and pluralism, they'd be very glad about what they did, as indeed they'd be glad about the whole way of freedom they have provided for us. I want to talk about some of the things about the guy who was introducing that concerned me about the First Amendment in our own time. I am very much concerned about a new force in American politics that reflects in some ways the old intolerances, but is a new political force, and I'll refer to it as the religious right in American politics. We are seeing now in the area of politics itself an entity called Christian Voice that each year grades the Congress on what they call now the pro-biblical voting rate. And every year, most of the Jews flunk, and the entire Black Caucus flunk, and all the clergy in the Congress flunk, and most of the women flunk. And people, based upon their interpretation of the Bible, if you're for aid to the conference, you are pro-biblical. If you're for sanctions against South Africa, you're anti-biblical. If you're for various provisions of women's rights, you're anti-biblical. If you are, however, for capital punishment, you are pro-biblical. And so we have a particular political philosophy baptized in a religious dress that is touted as the Christian, the moral, the pro-biblical way, while many people who are of devout faith, but who hear words, for example, like, I was hungry, you gave me meat, I was thirsty, you gave me a drink, as their marching orders from the Bible, are graded down because their beliefs differ from those who proclaim themselves to be the Christian voice in American politics. I'm concerned about candidates using religious intolerance in political campaigns by increasing religious tests for public office by an increasing number of groups. I'm also deeply concerned about what is happening in education. As all across the land, you hear the attacks on public education as a bulwark of secular humanism. a mythology. Most teachers are believers like most of you. Most educators are believers. They're trying to do something for that 89% of the children in this society who rely on the public school, and they need our help and our support. If we're going to do anything right in this society, we must make it a place of opportunity for its people, regardless of sex or race or economic situation or geographic location. That means excellence in public education. And this is a force that is undermining public confidence in public education. In Bristol, Virginia, Dr. Guy participated in a court case as to whether it was okay for the schools to teach the Bible and literature and history. Okay. But I know two couples in that community, a Methodist minister and his wife, another devout Methodist couple, and who decided that course taught by a fundamentalist minister was teaching their children things that violated their faith, in which they disbelieved. And so they threw their children out of that class. The children were ostracized, they were called by the other children in the student community, those little girls who don't believe the Bible. But the preacher's daughter, the daughter of another devout Methodist couple, because their interpretation of the Bible was different from that of the fundamentalist minister. Now, in Church Hill, Tennessee, and in Mobile, Alabama, we're involved in cases defending school systems against parents who find secular humanism in almost everything. They've decided that the Hope Reinhardt reading series in Church Hill may cause their children to become pacifists, humanists, internationalists, vegetarians, and there's one more, all of which believe to be in direct conflict with Christianity. And out of that case may come chaos in public education. In Mobile, Alabama, a group of folks have decided that the home economics courses are to secular humanism. We've had the Wizard of Oz rejected because it teaches witchcraft. We've had the Diary of Anne Frank rejected because she says you need to be a person of faith, but you can approach God from any different faith. And having faith is important, and that is her point of view, and that goes against the faith of those who consider anything but fundamentalist Christianity to be secular humanism. This is a problem in school district after school district, where schools are under attack, sometimes a book, sometimes a whole reading list, sometimes a whole curriculum, and it is a serious problem for our society, and it involves the First Amendment. Our schools, in the matter of creationism and evolution, our schools need to teach science as science and history as history and religion not at all. That is the province of the home and the church and the synagogue and not the school. I think my time is up.
Now, for the final summation, I'd like to introduce Dr. Buchanan again.
We who are American citizens have a heritage that is precious indeed. You know, our people and all their diversity are the true strength of this society. And to live in a country where we may believe one way or believe another or not believe at all and stand equal as citizens. To live in a society that protects and honors our most basic individual rights at every level of government is something very special in this world and something worth preserving for our children. We have entered a time in history where in education, in politics, in the life of our society, we have a new intolerance challenging that pluralism, that tolerance, that diversity that has helped to make us great. I think the First Amendment has protected religion as it has protected our individual liberty. I think the record says that, and it is something that we should cherish and sustain in our time. My final words, I'd like to talk just briefly about evolution and creationism because Dr. Gaff and I both testified before the Texas State School Board in the same hearing in which I was urging them to withdraw their evolution guidelines that were, from my point of view, adversely impacting the content of textbooks used all over the United States. And I say to you what I said to them. I can say with the psalmist, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament showeth his handiwork. I can say with Abraham Lincoln, the founder of my party, I cannot conceive how any man can stand gazing up into the heavens and say there is no God. But as I gaze up into the heavens from here in Texas, I'm also aware the space program, and the wonderful things that have been accomplished through science and technology, in chemistry and electronics and medical science and all the rest. And according to my faith, and the way I read my Bible, I do not have to choose between a universe of meaning and a purpose created by God and the truth as revealed in science. I believe the two can both give us insight into different areas of truth and are not in conflict. Those who preach a doctrine of inerrancy and interpretation of Scripture are talking about the inerrancy of their own positions. I believe the Bible, and I think I can believe the Bible and believe in science as well, and I do.
Now let's call upon Dr. Gosler for his final summation.
Perhaps the best way to focus the differences between our two points of view is by specific examples. Let's begin with the teaching of creation. About half of Americans believe in creation, and about three-fourths favor teaching both scientific creation and evolution in public schools. This being the case, then on what basis can the federal court discriminate against creationists by censoring their views from the public school? Clarence Darrow, the ACLU attorney in 1925 Scopes trial, said, quote, "It is bigotry for public schools to teach only one theory of origin." Yet the same ACLU argued in Arkansas and Louisiana that it's wrong to teach two theories of origin. But if it was bigotry in 1925 to teach only one view when just creation was being taught, then is it not also bigotry in 1987 to teach only one view when just evolution is being taught? In spite of the fact that this is obvious discrimination, the people of the American way continue to support censorship of creationist views in public schools. Let's take another example. Secular humanists declared themselves a religion in 1933 in Manifesto 1 and repeated this belief in 1973 in Manifesto 2. In the Torcaso case, 1961, the Supreme Court recognized secular humanism by name as an official religion in America. But by their own admission, secular humanists believe, contrary to the Declaration of Independence, that there is no creator of the universe, that man was not created but evolved, and there are no God-given moral absolutes such as the right to life. Now, while it's not wrong for the courts to recognize non-Christian religions such as secular humanism, it is a constitutional outrage for the courts to establish these humanist beliefs. Yet the courts have ruled in preference of humanistic beliefs that public schools cannot teach that there is a creator, or that man was created, or that there are God-given moral laws. Thus, by building their own wall of separation between church and state, the courts have in effect not only established the religion of secular humanism, but have declared the Declaration of Independence unconstitutional. But as anyone can clearly see, it is both constitutionally fallacious and un-American to so do. Why then does this group, who calls themselves the People for the American Way, support such un-American ways? One final example. There are many people who have sincerely held moral and religious beliefs about the right to abort their children, but in spite of these sincere religious beliefs, the state has compelling interest in the protection of the unalienable right to life guaranteed by the 5th and 14th Amendments. But while there are no constitutional limits on what one can believe, the court has ruled there are limits on the exercise of those beliefs, especially when they threaten someone else's life. No court-created right of privacy takes precedence over the constitutionally stated absolute right to life. For privately murdering is wrong, as is privately engaging in child sacrifice. But medical science has established the fact that a child's human life begins at conception. Indeed, the Hippocratic Oath, taken by physicians for over two millennia, forbids abortion. In 1716, American law also forbids abortion. In spite of all of this, in 1973, the Supreme Court in Rome by an act of raw judicial power, manufactured the right of privacy and exalted it over the absolute right to life. Since then, an American Holocaust of 20 million innocent babies has dwarfed the Nazi slaughter of 6 million Jews. Americans are killing little babies at the rate of 1.5 million a year, 4,100 a day, one every 20 seconds, all in the name of the right to exercise one's moral and religious beliefs. But surely this is an instance where compelling government interests must forbid the exercise of these private religious beliefs. For if the constitutional right to life is not protected for all who live here, citizens and aliens, born and unborn, then our 2,200-year celebration of this venerable document is a sham. For the right to life is the right to all other rights. Where there is no life, there is no liberty. Misuse of the Constitution should never be allowed to abridge God-given freedoms. For there is no essential difference whether the Supreme Court declares blacks or babies to be non-persons. This latter dread decision must be overturned as was the former. For as Abraham Lincoln noted, none of us are really free until all of us are truly free. Robbing anyone of the unalienable right to live is a deadly wrong. People for the American way may be for this, but the American people are surely not for this way. Thank you.
At this point, we'll accept 10 minutes of questions from the audience. The first question will be directed toward Dr. Buchanan, then to Dr. Geisler, and we'll rotate. One thing I would suggest, you should ask some questions. There's a difference between a question and a statement, and please remember this as you raise your hand and as you give your question. So now a question for Dr. Buchanan.
believing in his God. We don't know if our gods are the same, but if that's what it's all about, I'm asking you, sir.
Thank you. Of course, the First Amendment not only allows but mandates freedom of religion for all. That includes freedom of religion and freedom of speech and the right to life for all of the people who are here, black and white, born and unborn, creationists and evolutionists. My objection, however, is to those who want to mandate in our public schools and through our public institutions that only one point of view be taught. My objection is to those who want to mandate that people without due process of law, who have never had a chance to hire an attorney or to defend themselves, can be given capital punishment at the rate of 4,100 a day. I sympathize with the Indian cause, I sympathize with the black cause, and I sympathize with the cause of 20 million people who never got the right to life because organizations like the ACLU and People for the American Way are taking away civil liberties and the American way of life in the name of building a wall of separation between religion and state that never existed in the Constitution, that was never intended to be there except to protect us against people like that who are taking our liberties away.
Sir?
I'm sorry. Now I'd like to have a question for Dr. Buchanan.
Is it possible that the origin of life would require outside intelligent intervention, or can we only accept a naturalistic explanation which would include any God or intelligent intervention?
I am a believing Christian, and therefore I believe that this is a teleological universe with meaning and purpose, and I think that the universe, the wonder of the universe, of your body or mine, reflects an intelligent creator even more than this watch does. If I were to tell you this watch got itself together by some blind chance, you would tell me I was crazy. But therefore, as a believing person, I do believe the evidence indicates that there is a God and that the universe was created by him. I don't find that inconsistent with the fact that there can be an evolutionary process. The Bible itself says that 1,000 years in this sight are in a day. I don't think God is bound by our time. He lives in eternity, and he created time, and he is not bound by our finitude. So I think it's entirely possible, and what I believe is there is a God, that he created the world, that he may well have used an evolutionary process, that he may have taken a trillion years. It's nothing to him whether he took a second or a trillion years. But I don't think that is my religious belief. I don't think that belief should be taught in public school. That's my belief. I ought to teach it in my Sunday school, in my church, to my kids at home, and witness it on the street corner if I want to, and you can in this country, and people do.
Now a question for Dr. Gosling.
You just admitted that one of the greatest attributes of America is our freedom of speech and our freedom of religion, and yet you're saying that Christian values should be taught in schools. Don't you see that since the public schools are part of the government, that is saying that one religion is right, the Christianity view is right? Doesn't that go against the First Amendment, saying that they can't say that one church is right? I mean, what if I was a Buddhist and I sent my children to a school? I would not want them taught against my religion. I mean, don't you think it would be better just to keep it out and teach your values to your children at home?
I agree that sectarian religious values should not be taught in the public school. I believe that the public schools should not prefer any religion over any other religion. But that's precisely what has happened, because secular humanism is, by their own confession, a religion. Secular humanism was recognized by the Supreme Court as a religion. And the public schools today are teaching secular humanist values. I commend you the book Censorship Evidence in our children's textbook by Paul C. Fitz, and the book by Phyllis Schlafly, Child Abuse in the Classroom, that's on the table back there. These books document by hundreds of testimonies before the subcommittee that children were being taught secular humanist views contrary to their parents and the children's beliefs against their will in the
public school. If Thomas Jefferson, Madison, or Adams were here, they would consider that tyranny, because to force somebody to pay taxes and to force him to send his children, or to force those children to be subject in the public schools to the teaching of those views contrary to their religion, is defined as tyranny. They would surely start a second American Revolution. I don't think Christian values should be exclusively taught in public schools, and certainly secular humanist values should not be exclusively taught in the public schools. They should be truly pluralistic. But how can we claim that education is open? Education is excellent when we teach only one point of view. How can we claim that education is moral when we teach that there is no God and that God cannot be brought into the classroom? Our founding fathers and our country was built on the belief in the unalienable rights of a creator, absolute God-given moral laws. And we've reached the stage today in American public schools where you cannot even teach the principles of the Declaration of Independence because that's unconstitutional. I say that's an outrage. Let's get back to true pluralism in American school, which means to disestablish the preference that is given to humanist values in the public school and allow also Christian values to be taught alongside of humanist values and not to censor them out.
We'll have one final round of questions. The question for Dr. Buchanan.
Dr. Buchanan, in a city in my home state, a local Episcopalian group wanted to worship in a public park on Easter morning. They were forbidden by the courts because an association of atheists said that that was state-supported religion. Now, the county council had often stated that that park was open to any religious group, yet this Episcopalian group was still barred. That park belongs to the public, not to the government. How can you justify this move by the courts?
That was not my personal decision. I have to know more about the case because I might have ruled the other way. But since you asked the question, I have a minute. Let me respond. I think sometimes it's possible for a school administration and lower courts to err in their understanding of what the Supreme Court has ruled in the prayer and Bible study cases. That is, in ruling against state prescribed prayer and Bible reading, there are a lot of things you can do that are not yet forbidden by the Supreme Court in this interpretation of the First Amendment. But that may have been such a thing. I'd have to know more facts about it. I want to respond, though, very briefly, since I have the floor. I want you to understand that those who signed the Secular Humanist Manifesto, the Humanist Manifesto of 1933 and 73, and 33, it was a handful of people. In 73, it was a handful of people, average age 70. There are 3,000 members of the Humanist Society in the United States. This is not some big force representing all of education. It is a small group of people. Finally, the Supreme Court ruling you've been hearing about was not a ruling. It was a footnote in a Supreme Court decision that listed secular humanism among a group of non-theistic religions, a footnote to a justice's opinion pertaining to the Supreme Court decision. I just want to make those clear. Finally, People of the American Way is not involved in the abortion issue. We're a First Amendment rights and liberties organization. What we're for is your freedom, and not for some of the things you've been hearing.
Let's call upon one more question for Dr. Gosling.
Are you saying that at this point, Pony, that all views the Christian way and the secular humanistic way, or whatever you're saying, both should be taught side by side, or that religion should be separated from education totally and taught outside of the schools according to whatever your family may believe in and go to those different churches outside the school? Please clarify that for me.
Yes, what I'm saying is that either we must take values teaching out of the public school or truly represent in the curriculum the pluralism that exists in America. Secular humanists did declare themselves a religion, and conservatism goes far beyond the 3,000 people who are card-carrying members. If you want to read an interesting book, read David Ehrenfeld's book, The Arrogance of Humanism. Now, he is a humanist, and it's published by Cambridge Press. And in it, he says, secular humanism is the major religion of our time that's accepted by most all of the media all of the time. Three Eastern professors took the top 300 media elite and discovered that 88% of them hold a secular humanist point of view. Then Ehrenfeld says, if you ask them for the name of their religion, they probably give you the name of one of the traditional ones, but the truth of the matter is they're teaching secular humanist views and values. Let me give you an example. John Dunphy in the Humanist Journal, 1983, wrote this article, and he won the prize for this article. Now I ask you, is this the type of thing that you want in your free, open, pluralistic American schools? Quote, I am convinced that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in public school classrooms by teachers who correctly perceive their roles as proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity that recognizes and respects the spark of what theologians call divinity in every human being. These teachers, he says, must embody the same selfless dedication as the most rabid fundamentalist preachers, for they will be ministers of another sort, utilizing a classroom instead of a pulpit to convey humanist values in whatever subject they teach, regardless of the educational level, preschool, day school, or large state university. Now, he won the prize for that article. It was published in the Humanist Journal, and it's that kind of thing that many Americans who do not share these values are saying their religious views and their value views are being discriminated against, and we must stop that one-sided censorship of all Judeo-Christian views in preference of humanist views in the public schools, because if we do not, then private schools, which are starting at an alarming rate, which now take a large percentage of the population, will continue to grow. Homeschools will continue to grow. And the public school system, which already now produces 18% of the population illiterate by age 18, will continue to degenerate. I served on a public school board. My children went to a public school, but I want public schools to open themselves and not to be closed, especially against the very principles of our founding fathers. Thank you.
I'd like to thank both the speakers for today, Dr. Buchanan and Dr. Goss.